This podcast was recorded Wednesday, March 11th at 1:35 p.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear this. Yeah, like Governor DeWine in his next State of the State address will lay out some bolder proposals than doubling school recess time and banning AI child porn. Oh, wait, this was his last State of the State address. Oh, well. Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and all those Snollygosters, those shrewd politicians who, in their lame duck year, play it very safe. I'm Mike Thompson. Coming up in the podcast, more on Governor DeWine's State of the State address. But first, we had a presidential bombshell this week. No, we're not talking about President Trump calling the Iran war a short-term excursion. We're not even talking about the President of the United States. We're talking about the President of Ohio State University, who up and quit this week, or was forced to quit. Ted Carter's resignation came after it was revealed, and he acknowledged a, quote, improper relationship with a woman who was seeking public resources to support her personal business. We don't know all the details yet. The university says the matter is under investigation. It is looking at Carter's relationship with a podcaster who produced shows on post-military jobs. Carter is a retired Navy vice admiral. We should say the podcaster produced some of her shows here at WOSU in our studios under a private client contract. So, needless to say, it has been a strange few days here at Ohio State University and here at WOSU as we sort all of this out. The resignation brings to an end Carter's short 2-year stint as OSU's president. It was an eventful 2 years. He came into office as Palestinian protests were taking place at OSU and campuses around the country. President Trump was threatening schools who did not crack down on protesters and did not eliminate DEI programs. Tens of millions of dollars in federal research money was on the line. On the state government side, the Ohio legislature passed a new law that banned DEI programs. Carter actually did away with Ohio State's diversity office even before the bill became law. He banned chalking on campus sidewalks, we assume, for fear of controversial slogans underfoot that would get the attention of perhaps the Trump administration. On a good note, he did get to enjoy last year's football national championship by OSU, so he's got that going for him. While its end may have been unusual, Carter's tenure as a college president may not be all that uncommon. It's a job that has always been difficult, but it seems to be more and more difficult in recent years. To get a look at the practices and politics of the job of being a college president, we turn to Josh Moody. He's a reporter for Inside Higher Ed. Josh covers money and management in higher education. Josh, welcome to Snollygoster.
Thank you so much for having me.
You recently wrote a piece titled, 2025 was a bad year for college presidents. Will 2026 be any better? For Ted Carter, that would be a no. Now, you don't cover Ohio State closely, so we're not going to ask you to analyze the Ted Carter resignation in any detail, but what have you seen, or what kind of reaction have you seen in higher ed circles to this sudden departure?
His sudden exit surprised a lot of folks. He seemed to have struck the balancing act fairly well at Ohio State. He seemed to have a good touch with the legislature, so there seemed to be no immediate threat of him losing his job. And the fact that he did because of what was an unforced error, I think really surprised a lot of people. And I've seen reactions that ranged from shock to mockery. I've seen a lot of head shaking from people, especially faculty members, who can't believe he went out this way. And I've seen a lot of mockery from students online. And of course, this story has drawn a lot of national media attention, more so than some other presidential resignations that I've covered. And that's in part because Ohio State is a fairly big name. It's a nationally known university. but there is also a major whiff of scandal to this story. Yeah. And as you know, that tends to drive a lot of coverage.
Gets a lot of clicks. Yeah, a lot of head shaking. And I think the national reaction is pretty close to the reaction we all have here in Columbus is, as you said, he was navigating the political waters pretty well. And then all of a sudden this happened. It's like, whoa. Anyway, so he was in office 2 years. His predecessor, Christina Johnson, was in the job 2 years. Short stints in office, though, are becoming more and more common for college presidents, aren't they, Josh?
Yes, the college presidential term shrinking. We've seen survey data to suggest that it is getting shorter. And I'm actually working on a story today that should be out by the time this podcast airs that looks at turnover in the Big Ten.
Wow.
And the turnover in the Big Ten is quite high. There are 18 institutions in the Big Ten. And between last year and this year, nine have lost or will lose their presidents or chancellors. The ninth being the president or the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who's leaving to take the Columbia job. So some like Ted Carter is a rare example of someone who left due to scandal, but you have a bunch of others who left for various reasons, some like Michael Schill at Northwestern due to political pressure.
Yeah.
Some like Rodney Bennett at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, who stepped down after a faculty vote of no confidence related to program and job cuts. So presidential tenure is shrinking, but it's been quite dynamic in the Big Ten. The longest serving president or chancellor in the Big Ten, and I'm not counting systems, I'm just counting the member institutions themselves. The longest serving leader is Daryl Pines, who has been on the job since 2020.
2020, 6 years.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that fits because in 2022, the average tenure for a college president was just under 6 years. And that's a few years ago. It was 8.5 years 20 years ago. So, I mean, 8.5 year tenure, that's, you know, that's two terms as president of the United States. That seems to make sense. But, you know, 2, 4, 6 years is just, by the time you get your feet under you, you're heading out. Ohio State now is about to, we're not sure what they're going to do, but if they have a search, it'll be their third search in 5 years. I mean, it's just, it's really, really kind of crazy. We'll get to the politics in a moment. But has the job itself changed all that much? You know, university presidents, they've always had to deal with annoying faculty, rambunctious students, demanding donors, unrealistic football and basketball fans and boosters. What, if anything, is different about the actual job right now?
The job seems to be getting harder because it is increasingly political. State legislatures, for example, are increasingly intervening in governance decisions. Lawmakers are also taking aim at DEI programs and, in many cases, restricting campus speech. There's also mounting federal pressure from the Trump administration, and presidents are trying to keep their heads down, trying to scrub policies that will attract attention. And then you have a lot of public pressure. Campus controversies are often tied to culture war issues that become nationalized. The social media outrage machine is always churning, and there are multiple constituents that you have to please.
Yeah, that's always been the trouble with college presidents because, you know, the faculty always thinks they run the university. The donors think they run the universities. In some cases, they do, but you know, at least have a major influence, the donors do. And then what I always heard up until recently, up until the past, you know, 5 years or so, was that a lot of college presidents hated the fact that they always had to be raising money. That was number one. Can you raise money? Raise money, raise money, raise money. Is that not as big a complaint anymore? It's more the politics?
That's still a major part of the job, but that is a part of the job that is not as difficult as the politics. You're not as likely to be to attract controversy unless you take some questionable donation, whereas yeah. Politics is always a lightning rod for controversy.
Yeah. You mentioned Northwestern and the Big Ten. Most of the Big Ten schools are public schools. Is the job easier for private school presidents versus public school presidents?
That is what sources tell me. I had a conversation with an expert on college presidencies for the story that I'm writing, and he essentially argued, he used the University of Wisconsin, Madison, as an example, where their chancellor, Jennifer Mnuchin, is leaving to take the Columbia job. Now, despite all the federal pressure on Columbia University, this expert argued that's an easier job because you don't have to go deal with the legislature every budget season or other lawmakers, state lawmakers, who are breathing down your neck over something that they don't like.
Yeah. Now, college presidents do get well paid.
Absolutely.
Ted Carter was making about $1.5 million when he left. That's not unusual. The salaries have increased for these presidents, correct?
Yeah, the salaries keep going up, and so do the demands. These presidents are incredibly well paid, but it is a very, very difficult job.
Yeah, still not as well paid as the football coach in many universities, but still, that's another podcast discussion. Anyway, let's get to 2025. It was a tough year for college and universities presidents. You mentioned the several that had left. Presidents of Columbia, Northwestern, Virginia, Texas A&M all left their jobs. You know, at least part are directly related to state and federal politics. And you did a survey, and you said that, and you found your higher ed, Inside Higher Ed, found that politics was weighing heavily on their minds this year, college presidents.
Yes. Every year we do a survey of college and university presidents. It's 16 years in. And this year, 430 college leaders took our survey. And the chief concerns that they raised were political pressure, financial uncertainty, and a growing concern is how AI is reshaping higher education and society.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned that universities are all about academic freedom. And so they're facing the pressure from both sides. You're facing the pressure from students and faculty saying, stand up to the state legislature here in Ohio, who's that banned the DEI programs and wants to control the curriculum. Stand up to President Trump, who's threatening funding if you don't do similar things. How are presidents navigating that? Have they figured it out yet?
Most are keeping their heads down. They are quietly scrubbing policies that they worry will attract attention, policies related to DEI, for example. You have seen the presidential statement essentially vanish, at least when it comes to political issues. Many universities have adopted institutional neutrality policies where they are no longer taking stances on something, even when it affects the core mission. Although it seems that some have expanded this notion of institutional neutrality, that even when the core mission is being directly affected, they aren't speaking out. A very, very small number of presidents are pushing back directly. And in our survey, it was 2% indicated that their institutions are in, quote, active resistance mode, where they are challenging federal policies through the courts or through other advocacy efforts.
2%.
2%.
Wow.
And this isn't necessarily reflected in our survey, but I've also covered the lobbying picture for higher education, and universities are spending a lot more money, at least over the last year. Numbers aren't ready for 2026 yet, but colleges spent a lot more money over the last year lobbying than in the prior year.
Yeah, I mean, that was the next question. Can universities push back? The fact that only 2% feel they can answers that question, I guess. Right now, they feel their hands are tied.
Yeah, there are some channels. Those channels are limited. Lobbying is a major channel. There have been some wins. Some things the Trump administration has wanted to do has not came to fruition. Congress, for example, has done things like keep money flowing to minority-serving institutions, which Trump wanted to cut off. So there are examples that you see of what appears to be wins in terms of college priorities.
Can a private university president push back more than a public university president? Because, you know, Ohio State, for instance, they rely on the state legislature for some of their funding.
Yeah, absolutely. There's going to be a lot of pressure on a public university president if they speak out that a private university president would not have to deal with, the legislature being the chief example.
Yeah, that's the thing with Ted Carter. You know, just put aside the scandal that ended his tenure here. He was a guy who was keeping, you nailed it. He was keeping his head down. He was, this law that passed about a year and a half ago, they call it Senate Bill 1. It's the anti-DEI law, which was designed to promote more conservative thought on campus. And they established a center in the public affairs, public policy school that was geared towards diversifying the content that is taught and lectures that were coming in. And he wasn't really gaining the attention of state lawmakers or even the Trump administration. A little, you know, here and there, things would flare up. But he really was. He's a retired military guy. He came in. When Ted Carter first got here, he said, the lawmakers make the law and we follow them. And that was, I think that was music to the ears of lawmakers in Columbus here. And it's really kind of surprising that it kind of ended this way, because he was, I think, pretty safe in his job.
Yes. So a little background here. I met Ted Carter when he was president of the University of Nebraska system, and had interviewed him while he was in that job. And I always thought he had a good touch with the legislature in Nebraska, and he seemed to carry that over into Ohio as well. And I don't know his personal politics, but his military background seemed to give him some instant conservative credibility that I think a lot of presidents coming from in the more common academic route don't necessarily always have.
At Ohio State, I don't want to go too far back, but they always seem to go pendulum. They had Gordon Gee on his second term, which he was everywhere. He was gregarious. He was out there. He's sometimes getting in trouble for saying the wrong thing. He left, you know, kind of under a bit of a cloud, and they brought in a very low-key President Michael Drake, former a doctor. He was very low-key. He was here for 5 years, and they brought in Christina Johnson, who worked for the Obama administration, pretty liberal. She said released some statements, you know, during the whole George Floyd protest and social justice, racial justice turmoil of 2020. And when she left, they brought in a retired vice admiral from the Navy. So it's just like, that's the way Ohio State is going. I don't know who follows Ted Carter now, if we keep going on that pendulum, but that would seem to be what OSU is trying to do.
I have had some conversations with experts about that very question, who follows Ted Carter. I've seen a lot of speculation that someone like Jim Tressel will potentially get the job. But what experts told me that they expect Ohio State to focus on in the presidential search is basically someone who has experience running an institution like Ohio State that has a major footprint, that is a large research university, that has a major athletics program, but someone who has done that in a red state.
Yeah,
because they're going to have to contend with red state politics.
Yeah, interesting. We record this on Wednesday afternoon. The Board of Trustees meets Thursday morning, so things may have changed by the time you hear this. And we should know more as to who's going to lead the university on an interim or a permanent basis, probably even by the time you hear this. That leads to my next question. Who the heck wants this job? You know, I mean, there's so many things going on right now, not to mention the normal pains of being a college president, but the politics and everything else that's going on in the world. Who's applying? Who's going for these jobs?
You know, I've asked that same question for the story that I'm writing. And what experts told me is that Ohio State is a very attractive job. Mm-hmm. It is a large, nationally known brand. It is a research university that is well regarded. It is financially healthy. So it is one of arguably the more attractive jobs out there, politics aside. Mm-hmm. So it will probably get quite a few applicants. It's hard to say. I don't have a crystal ball to predict, but I would suspect that people who are similarly positioned, maybe presidents or chancellors of schools, public institutions in red states, are likely to advance in the search.
Now, in your piece, you wrote that a lot of schools are hiring from within, perhaps as a better path. You know, elevating somebody who's already working for the university, knows how it operates, and has, you know, built-in knowledge and contacts.
Yes, that's been quite common. It seems like there have been a lot of cases once universities appoint an interim or acting president, where they just end up in the job, depending on how they do in that interim period. So I think any interim they appoint, you have to consider the fact they're possibly gunning for the job and may even have a good chance of getting.
How about outsiders, politicians? I mean, Ted Carter was kind of an outsider. He came from the Navy, but he had been superintendent at the Naval Academy. He had worked at Nebraska, like you said. So he had some academic pedigree in his resume.
Yeah, there is what I would say is a noticeable increase in presidents who are coming into the job without climbing the academic ladder necessarily, especially in red state public universities. I wrote a story about Florida. I believe the headline was Florida's GOP presidential hiring spree, and they are just hiring college presidents who are former politicians left and right. I mean, their lieutenant governor stepped down to take a college presidency. Look at Texas. You see multiple former lawmakers being tapped for leadership roles there. So that is an absolute strong growing trend, especially in red states. But another trend I've noticed recently is you are seeing more people with legal backgrounds entering the presidency. And with everything, all the political turmoil going on right now, I think a lot of boards feel a little more comfortable with the lawyer in the job.
Interesting. Well, Josh Moody, reporter for Inside Higher Ed, we really appreciate your time giving us a national perspective on not the scandal, but the whole job of being a college president and how tumultuous it is these days. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
We'll be right back.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.
Welcome back to Snollig Oster. A reminder, if you like what you're hearing, we ask you to give us a good review on your podcast platform of choice, and be sure to follow or subscribe. That way you don't miss an episode. And of course, our best marketing is word of mouth. So spread the Snollig Oster word. Governor DeWine this week gave his final State of the State address. Next year, he'll be retired. And we assume Democrat Amy Acton or Republican Vivek Ramaswamy will address the state legislature. It should come as no surprise, but Governor DeWine played it safe. This week, very safe in his swan State of the State address, he spent about a quarter of his hour-long speech talking about the science of reading. He spent a quarter of his speech talking about phonics and how a new state law mandating it is paying off with better reading scores. That's great. He called for tougher seatbelt laws, especially for kids. He asked lawmakers to get tough and ban AI child porn. Boy, that's going to be a tough sell. My personal favorite, he wants to double the amount of recess time in school from 30 minutes a day to 60 minutes.
Recess gives children the chance to get outside and just be kids. It increases their physical activity. It improves their memory, their attention, their concentration. It helps them stay on task while they're in the classroom. It reduces disruptive behavior in the classroom. It improves children's ability to learn how to share and negotiate. A lot of life skills.
This is for kids K through 8th grade. Thoughts to teachers monitoring eighth grade recess. Anyway, maybe the governor is trying to soften the blow for those kids who can't use their phones in school anymore because of a law he signed. That was another highlight of his State of the State speech. It is safe to say Governor DeWine wants his legacy to be he tried to take care of kids, help them live up to their God-given potential, as he often says. But he said nothing on the cost of living, nothing on skyrocketing property taxes, nothing about the cost of daycare to help families with young kids, nothing on the death penalty, which he's talked about recently. He did talk about his clean water initiative, but he didn't ask lawmakers to pay for it. Now, since COVID, Governor DeWine has done his best to avoid controversy, and in his last State of the State address, he did just that. Time now for our Snollygoster of the Week segment, where we honor the shrewdest politician or political move of the past 7 days. This week, the word goes to Senator John Houston. He testified this week in the first energy executive nuclear bailout bribery trial. When he was lieutenant governor, he supported the bailout, but attorneys say he could not testify at the trial in person because of the ongoing war in Iran. So attorney said Houston had to testify by video because he had to stay in Washington to monitor the war. But Channel 5 in Cleveland reports Houston did travel back to Ohio this past weekend for a fundraiser. So, for part-time, sometimes remote, war monitoring, Senator John Houston gets our Snollygoster of the Week award. We'll probably talk about his testimony next week on Snollygoster. That will do it for this week's edition of Snollygoster. We are a part of the NPR network, proud member we are. For our digital producer, Michael DeBonis, our audio engineer, Dalton Jones, I'm Mike Thompson for WOSU Public Media.